Today at Reader's Corner, Pulitzer Prize finalist Henry William Brands, author of American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism.
Before about 1850, corporations hardly existed in the United States. And in fact, corporations in the early days of the American Republic had to be chartered one by one by special pieces of legislation. It's a remarkable irony that the greatest capitalists during this period were, by their actions, the worst enemies of capitalism itself. The beginning of the 20th century, the United States had the largest, most powerful, and dynamic economy in the world. And it was largely a consequence of this partnership between private enterprise and public enterprise.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In the decades following the Civil War, American industrialism exploded, forging the largest, most productive, and most technically advanced economy in the world. It was a transformation that introduced names like J.P. Morgan, Carnegie, Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, and set the stage for the nation's rise as a superpower in the 20th century. Today's guest, historian Henry William Brands, tells us about this metamorphosis in his new book, American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism. Dr. Brands examines how the energy released by the end of the war between North and South eventually challenged the nation's great experiment with representative government, creating an ongoing cyclical struggle between the twin value systems of democracy and capitalism. Dr. Brands is the Dixon Allen Anderson Centennial Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin and a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist for his biographies The First American, The Life and Times of Benjamin Franklin, Traitor to His Class, The Privileged Life and Radical Presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He is the author of more than 20 books on American history, and his articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Atlantic Monthly, and many other national publications. Dr. Brands was a guest on our show in 2007 to discuss his book, The Age of Gold, The California Gold Rush and the American Dream, and we are pleased to welcome him back today. He joins us by phone from Austin, Texas. Bill Brands, welcome back to Reader's
Happy
Corner.
With you.
Well, tell us about your day job, Bill. I mean, you're obviously writing is your day job as well, but you must teach students at the University of Texas. What kind of classes do you conduct?
I teach every level of students from entering freshmen to PhD students. I have, in the fall semester, this last semester, I taught 300 students their first course on American history. So they're freshmen, sophomores, right out of high school. Some were transfer students. I teach them. I teach upper-level undergraduates, and I teach graduate students from the beginning to the end of their course. So I get the whole gamut of students.
That's neat. You may not want to discriminate like this, but I remember from my days in teaching, I would always come away with ideas and thoughts about the topic I was covering that just hadn't occurred to me until I engaged in these dialogues with students who had these interesting perspectives. Where do you get most of those in your experience? Is it the more sophisticated graduate student, or is it the student who just walks in and has never been exposed to the United States history from 1865 to 1900?
It comes from both directions, and as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons that I make a point of teaching both the introductory students, the ones who really don't know that much, and the students who've specialized and are going to become historians in their own right. The students who don't have much background, they ask what might seem to be naive questions, but those are the ones that you have to think hardest about answering. So when somebody asks a question, why was there an Industrial Revolution in America? If you spend all of your time studying the Industrial Revolution, you might well come to think somehow or other it was inevitable. But if you step back, you realize, well, no, it didn't have to happen. It happened in the United States. It happened in some other countries, but it didn't happen in every country. So what was it? So the introductory students ask the big questions, and they really enforce on a teacher and on an author a kind of discipline, because if you are writing for a specialized audience, they'll stick with you if you go on at great length on this, that, or the other thing. But if you're writing for a general audience, I have to explain the transformation of the railroad industry in two or three paragraphs. I don't get a whole book on the subject. And so I have to choose what are the most important things to say about that development or any other one. And as I say, it enforces a kind of discipline on me as a teacher, but then as an author. Some people ask me how I am able to balance my writing with my teaching. And the fact is that they reinforce each other, because I get to try out my ideas on my students, And if I can tell a story to my students, if I can get the students to follow along with me and understand what I'm trying to say, then I think I have a pretty good chance of putting it down on paper and conveying it to readers. And so my students, I like to joke with them, and they sort of laugh. They have to laugh. They're my students. They say, I tell them that they're my guinea pigs, and I try out my ideas on them. And I deliberately make the ideas as provocative as I can to see how far I can push them until somebody says, Professor Brands, are you crazy? That can't be true. And then I step back and say, well, okay, maybe not. So it's a great combination for me.
Well, a couple of years ago, you and 11 of your distinguished colleagues had a chance to have dinner at the White House with President Barack Obama. And I just wonder if you could tell us anything about how 12 historians got together to test out their ideas on the president and what came of that evening.
Well, in the first place, you as a teacher can appreciate the fact that we like to think that if the student-teacher ratio is, say, 11 to 1, that's a pretty good deal.
Right.
In fact, in this case, it was 1 to 11. One student, 11 teachers. When I went in, first of all, I was quite honored and flattered to be included in this group. And as I traveled to the White House, I was trying to think, what other presidents would have been inclined to do this sort of thing, would have thought it was worth a couple hours of their time to spend with a small group of historians? And there really are very few presidents. Thomas Jefferson probably would have. Woodrow Wilson, maybe. He was a historian himself. Theodore Roosevelt, but Theodore Roosevelt would have done all the talking. He would have invited the historians, but he would have done all the talking. But anyway, President Obama invited us, and it became very clear that what he wanted was some perspective on how previous presidents had dealt with particular challenges of their presidencies. He was, I have to say, he was, well, if he had been a student in my class, in one of my graduate seminars, he wouldn't have gotten all that high a mark for that particular evening because he listened. He didn't talk. Now, students in my seminars, I insist that they talk. But, you know, needless to say, you can't insist on anything when you're at the White House with the president. But it really indicated his purpose, which was to hear from people who had spent, I don't know what the total amount of time and service would have been if we added it up for everybody around the table, but it's been conservatively a couple centuries together studying presidents and see what they had to say. And so it was a very interesting evening. President Obama was careful not to give away too much. As I say, he listened. He didn't talk much. He mostly listened. I know what I got out of it. I got a nice dinner. I got a chance to see the president up close and try to figure out what it was about him that had convinced people early in his political career that he was somebody they could get behind. I'm not exactly sure what he got out of the evening, but I guess he got enough that he invited us back for a second time. So anyway, it was a great experience.
Well, let's pick up on the presidents and talk about the presidents in the context of this history you've written of America from 1865 to 1900. Most of the reviews that have discussed your book, and of course, in reading your book, I had a chance to learn a lot more about some of those characters that I mentioned in the intro, the Morgans, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts. We could add to those Leland Stanford that built Stanford University. In fact, it's kind of interesting that most of these names have universities attached to them these days in their philanthropic objectives over the years. These guys left something behind. But I guess the question is, we all know the role these folks played, thanks to your great history of this period and that of many others. But what about the presidents in this period? What's going on in the White House in this period? And what's going on in the Supreme Court? I guess I remember enough from my constitutional law days that over on the Supreme Court, there for a while, there were lots of Supreme Court decisions basically validating all of the abuses of the industrial system that these characters had installed. It only was later that started unraveling. But your thoughts on the role the presidents played in these years?
Well, the short answer to the question about what were the presidents up to during this period is less than you might think. And I say that because, with the exception of Ulysses Grant, and Grant is to some extent a president of this period of the Gilded Age, but he's also really a president of the Civil War era. Grant's elected because he was the victorious Union general in the Civil War. And the principal issues that he discerned during his presidency were those relating to Reconstruction, putting the country back together after the war. With Grant, the principal concern, a principal concern, was civil rights. Grant was the only president between Abraham Lincoln and Lyndon Johnson to take civil rights at all seriously. Grant waged a determined fight on behalf of African Americans, hoping to cause the South to respect and enforce the Civil Rights Amendments, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But he found that it was a losing cause. The South resisted the idea, and the North gradually lost interest in the idea. After Grant, presidents fade into the background, in part because this was still the era when Congress dominated federal politics. Presidents in those days didn't lead the national government the way presidents do now. In fact, it's not till the very end of this period, when Theodore Roosevelt becomes president, that the presidency becomes the center of focus of American political life. Now, you asked about the Supreme Court. In certain respects, that was the most important legacy of the presidents, because the presidents, then as now, nominate members to the Supreme Court.
Sure.
The Senate has to confirm. But the principal function, the principal accomplishment of the Supreme Court during this period was to, first of all, to define corporations as individuals, legal individuals with the rights of individuals. And this gave corporations the opportunity to engage in all sorts of things that corporations hadn't done before. It's probably worth a reminder to your listeners that before about 1850, corporations hardly existed in the United States. And in fact, corporations in the early days of the American Republic had to be chartered one by one by special corporate charters, special pieces of legislation that would incorporate these companies. General incorporation laws where, okay, this is what you have to do, fill out these forms, meet these requirements, and then you got a corporation. Those didn't kick in until the middle of the 19th century. But exactly what the function of corporations was and how they would be treated by the courts was something the courts had to figure out. One of the things the Supreme Court did during the period from 1865 to 1900, the period that I write about in the book, is they provided a very friendly framework of support for corporations and for businesses. As one example, in 1890, Congress passed something called the Sherman Antitrust Act, and it was designed by the people who wrote it, including John Sherman, to rein in the power of corporations by defining certain practices as illegally in restraint of trade. The feeling was that big corporations were getting too powerful, and in those days, the term of art was trust for a big monopoly, big corporation, and that's why it was called an antitrust law. And the hope was to rein in the power of corporations. But the courts, especially the Supreme Court, determined that the Sherman antitrust law did not actually, or at least did not in practice, apply to corporations. What it applied to and what it forbade was the organizing practices of labor unions. So while it was designed to rein in the corporations, in fact, by the interpretations of the court, it had exactly the opposite effect.
To the extent that we talk about capitalism as the free enterprise system, these characters at the top of the American economic system in those days were fiercely monopolistic, almost challenging the definition of capitalism as competition.
It's a remarkable irony that the greatest capitalists, certainly during this period, were by their actions the worst enemies of capitalism itself. If, as you said, you define capitalism, as most people do, as the free operation of markets based on competition, on equality of entry, and all of this stuff. John Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, they all started out in relatively modest fashion, especially Rockefeller and Carnegie, and they entered competitive markets. But as they succeeded, they eliminated competition until Carnegie Steel Corporation, which was combined with various other corporations in 1901 by J.P. Morgan to create the United States Steel Corporation, had this huge industrial trust that utterly dominated the iron and steel industry in the United States. John Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company had a nearly perfect monopoly of oil refinery and transportation. And so these individuals believed in private enterprise, but they had grave doubts about the free market, if free market meant competition. Rockefeller thought that competition was wasteful. Rockefeller spent his life trying to eliminate competition.
In this post-Civil War era, how important was the South to the robber barons economic model that really comes out of the North?
Until the Civil War, the South was a region and an economy apart. There were specific connections. The cotton business in the South was connected to the markets in the North. But for the most part, the South was not part of the national capitalistic economy, if for no other reason, that the model of labor mobilization in the South was feudal. It was based on slavery rather than on wage labor. With the end of slavery and the end of the Civil War, the South had to be integrated into the national economy. It did so with some considerable difficulty. One of the basic problems the South had was that there wasn't any money. Before the Civil War, the South operated, as I say, as a feudal economy, which cash was not that big a deal. Most labor wasn't paid. The war ends, slavery ends, and all of a sudden, employers in the South have to figure out how to compensate their workers when they don't have any money to do it. They can't pay wages the way employers in the North do. So they did something that would really see, for your listeners, for our generation, was most common in Silicon Valley, in California, in the 1980s and 1990s. What do you do when you're starting a business and you need to enlist suppliers, employees, and you don't have any money? Well, you give them shares of the enterprise. And that's the way any number of Silicon Valley startups got going. That's the way the venture capitalists work. Well, that's what they did in the South, except the shares were a share of the crop. And the sharecropping system, which fairly quickly became notorious for its abuses, actually began as a fairly enlightened and forward-looking way of linking the interests of the laborers, in many cases the former slaves, and the employers, the plantation owners. Because the idea was, if there's a good crop, we share in that. If there's a bad crop, we share in the misfortune. As I say, abuses very quickly arose, and so the balance was utterly tipped in favor of the employers, the plantation owners. But it was a start.
You're listening to H.W. Bill Brands. He is the author of American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism. Let's pursue this question regarding the Southern economy. You single out railroads in particular for helping to foster the growth of the economy, and you contrast at one point in your book when you're talking about cities, Memphis and Atlanta, Memphis, the old river town, and then Atlanta, which apparently grew up thanks to this railroad expansion sweeping the nation.
If you look at the map of the United States even today, and you figure out where big cities are located, if there's a big city that's located on a coast or at an important river junction, you can almost certainly bet that that city was founded and probably came to prominence before the age of the railroad. If you look at cities that aren't on important waterways, Atlanta, Dallas, Denver, you can guarantee that those cities were children of the railroad age. Because the essential function of cities is to connect people, connect farmers to markets, connect one market to another market. They're nodes of transportation. And until the railroad came along, transportation was largely, efficient transportation was largely confined to waterways. Once the railroads come along, then things can really boom. The huge success story of the cities of this period was Chicago. And Chicago benefits from both because after the Erie Canal was completed, Chicago became, in essence, a seaport. Lake Michigan is sort of the westernmost extension of the Atlantic Ocean via the Hudson River, the Erie Canal, and the Great Lakes. But Chicago is also the railroad gateway to the entire inland, especially the upper Midwest. And so even today, you can see that if you just look at a map of where cities look, you can tell they were creations of the water age or they were creations of the railroad age. Now, later cities might be, some of them would be creations of the automobile age.
Now, the nation is moving west during the same period you're reporting of the rise of the robber barons. To what extent does unbridled capitalism manifest itself in this sweep westward?
Well, one of the striking things is that capitalism was really never unbridled. Certainly during this period, capitalism operated hand in glove with the federal government. And you ask about railroads. The transcontinental railroads, the great railroads that link the West Coast to the eastern half of the United States, the ones that knit the country together, the ones that created the secret of America's economic success going forward, that secret was the largest single economic market in the world. Those railroads were created by a partnership between private enterprise and the federal government. If not for federal subsidies in the form of land grants and loans, the transcontinental railroads would not have been built for decades more. There simply wasn't the traffic to warrant the private investment to build the railroads. But the Republican Party, and this is something else that's worth noting for modern listeners and readers, the Republican Party in those days was the party of big government. And it was the party of big government specifically to support business. The Democrats in those days, that was the party of small government. The Democrats were suspicious of big business. They were suspicious of big government. But the Republican Party during the Civil War and after the Civil War sponsored the creation of railroads across the West. And this was what knitted the country together. It's what made California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho part of the national economy in a way that had not been before. And it caused the economy as a whole to boom. It was really the secret of America's economic success. By the beginning of the 20th century, the United States had the largest, most powerful, and dynamic economy in the world. And it was largely a consequence of this partnership between private enterprise and public enterprise.
I want to go back just for a moment, even though I do want to come back to our favorite robber barons. But when we were talking about the South, I meant to ask you a question about Booker T. Washington and his Atlanta Compromise speech, because I was particularly fascinated about this man of letters who emerged in the 19th century as the most educated black man in America. At least that's the way he came off to those who read about him in the 20th and the 21st century. And yet when it comes to capitalism, at least to some extent, he jumped right in.
Booker Washington has gotten a bit of a bad press in the last 30 or 40 years by people who think that he should have pushed harder for full equality for African Americans during his time. But Booker Washington was one of the shrewdest political minds, was one of the shrewdest political operators of his day. He understood, first of all, that democracy can move no faster than you can get a majority to move. And secondly, that the real need of blacks in the South was not the vote, it was economic opportunity. Washington believed that if economic opportunity were allowed African Americans, then they would achieve the success that would eventually lead to political equality. But he made, well, the so-called Atlanta Compromise, and the compromise was with whites, give us the opportunity to succeed economically, and we will leave aside the question of full political and social equality for later. It was a provocative position in those days. There were northern liberals who thought this was a terrible compromise, but there were many people in the South who thought this was the shrewd, the smart thing to do.
If you had to choose one of these robber barons, Rockefeller, Morgan, Vanderbilt, and again, there's others you could name, who comes to mind as the most fascinating and the most surprising in the research you did?
I would say Andrew Carnegie, because Carnegie embodies the immigrant dream, arrives penniless with his family from Scotland at the age of 12, becomes enormously successful through his native intelligence, through his diligence, but all the while can't quite transcend the working class origins of his family. He likes to think of himself as an enlightened employer, but nonetheless, he becomes the focus of one of the most bitter labor disputes of the 1890s, the Homestead Strike Massacre of 1892, in which there was gunfire between the Pinkerton guards who were protecting one of his plants and the workers. And Carnegie, from that point on, had to deal with his uneasy conscience that somehow he had failed his father's memory. The reason his family came to America was that his father was an unemployed textile worker. And so he spends the rest of his life trying to assuage this guilt complex by doing these philanthropic good works. So he's a fascinating character. He is, yes, he's the robber baron type, but he also is something of the philosopher prince. And he sets the model for modern philanthropy. And you can see it right down to Bill Gates today.
What's fascinating about this study of this period, and your book just does it so well, is the extent to which when you finish reading it, you get to about 1900, you realize that the United States has emerged as this very powerful nation in spite of all the shortcuts we took to get there, in spite of the monopolistic practices of these characters at the top. And I have to ask, I guess, historians in general, and you in particular, Bill, we move into the 20th century and we have to fight two world wars and along the way beat back repressive and fascist governments. And you have to wonder if America could have done that if it didn't have the industrial backbone and foundation that these characters developed in the 19th century, which today, of course, in the enlightened 21st century, we decry as horrible, backward ways of doing business with human beings in the labor markets and what have you. But it got us through two world wars that we had to win.
Well, as a teacher yourself, you'll appreciate that with my students every semester, I give them sort of, with a wink of the eye, what I call Brands's Laws of History. And Brands's first law of history as it relates to foreign affairs is, sooner or later, every country gets the foreign policy it can afford. And you hit it exactly right. It was the enormous success of the American economy, the success that was achieved by this generation from 1865 to 1900 and then built upon by later generations, that allowed the United States to have the very ambitious, sometimes visionary, sometimes simply imperialistic, foreign policy of the 20th century. And if you want to know the secret of America's success in foreign policy in World War I, World War II, and afterwards, and if you want to know the secret of some of America's failures, perhaps by overreaching, it was that the United States was far and away the richest country in the world during the 20th century. Now, one of the questions that I pose to my students when I have a class in American foreign policy is the 21st century going to be like that or is it going to be different? The country is clearly running up against limits on its discretionary spending. And will Americans decide that, you know what, we're not as rich as we used to be? And will Americans start to apply a more stringent cost-benefit analysis to their visions of what the foreign policy of the country should entail?
Well, let's keep the focus on the 21st century. We are emerging from a recession that was fueled by greed and corruption on a grand scale, at least in finance and banking. So what did J.P. Morgan have on us?
Well, it definitely is the case that if you look at what happened in 2008 and after, you can see foreshadowings of this. In the 1870s, there was a big panic, a financial panic in 1873, and 1893, another one. Now, one of the differences, though, is that when the panic occurred in 2008, political figures, elected officials of both parties, immediately said the government has to do something about it. The government has to step in and provide a safety net. The government didn't do this in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s. In 1895, when the U.S. Treasury was in dire straits, there was a run on the American gold supply. It wasn't a case of the federal government stepping in to save the private sector. It was the private sector that stepped in to save the federal government. J.P. Morgan put together a small consortium that floated an emergency loan to the federal government to save the U.S. Treasury. So the economy has grown much more complicated. It's grown much more connected with the world. And there is this odd way in which there's been an overturning. As I say, back in the 1890s, it was the private bankers that rode to the rescue of the federal government. In our era, it's the federal government that rides to the rescue of the private bankers.
Well, Bill, we've run out of time, but I really do appreciate your joining us today on Reader's Corner. Again, it's H.W. Brand's book, American Colossus, The Triumph of Capitalism, 1865 to 1900. Thanks for joining us today, Bill.
As always, great fun.
Next week, Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age, New York. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week at Reader's Corner as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world.